Sudan, once Africa's biggest country, has been in conflict for so many years. When South Sudan became independent, it was supposed to usher in a new period of peace and stability in the region. But now, Southern Kordofan. At its heart is the Nuba Mountains, where some 50 black African tribes have lived for thousands of years. Now there's fighting there once more in one of the most remote corners of a vast country.
Well, the president of Sudan is Omar Hassan al-Bashir, who's been in power since 1989, had a coup.
Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar!
And he's an absolute dictator. He's a guy who's been indicted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes and crimes against humanity for what he did in Darfur.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor and retired FBI profiler. And today with me is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, advocate and author, founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for Criminal Minds, where Jim Clementi is my colleague, and we will be going into our 13th season. So congratulations, my friend. We have jobs for next year. And I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes.
And today we have a very special guest with us.
Jim, Laura, Lisa, it's Ken Carlson. I'm thrilled to be here. I'm a writer, a producer, and a director in the Hollywood Hills here of California.
And today we're going to be talking about a documentary movie that you made, which touched all of us here at Real Crime Profile, particularly in its focus on the victims of war crimes in Sudan.
Yeah, it's a film that I recently completed, and it's a there's a narrative that I run through. It's a friend of mine, Tom Katina. He's the only doctor within 200 miles for about a million people in this war-torn area.
And the documentary is called The Heart of Nuba, and it's set in Sudan, the southern part of Sudan, in the mountains there, called the Nuba Mountains.
Correct, yes. And this is a, you know, this is next to the Blue Nile District. There's two regions that Omar Hassan al-Bashir, the president of Sudan, is now focusing on. He's worked his way through Darfur, still there committing a lot of war crimes, but he's now focused on the Nuba Mountains in the Blue Nile District, and he's committing a genocide like he did in Darfur. So it's a very serious thing, and I decided to turn a camera on it. But once again, I have a narrative that my narrative is Dr. Tom Katina, so we understand the conflict and the people in this region through his eyes.
Just for the edification of our listeners who don't know the history here, back in 2011, the country of Sudan was split into Sudan and South Sudan. The main country, Sudan, is mainly Muslim now, and South Sudan is not. And that happened because after the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, a lot of Muslims fled from those countries into Sudan, which was basically without a leader at the time, right?
So it's actually rather complicated, and I do not profess to be an expert in this area. I know when crimes have taken place, and I know good people, and I know people that are heroes that are taking, you know, that are stepping up. But the actual history is very, you know, convoluted, and it starts back with the colonization from Egypt and England. It's very difficult part of the world. They have been experiencing conflict for decades and decades.
Right,
it's really centuries about tribal.
Conflict is a very sterile word.
Mm-hmm.
What you're talking about in your documentary is not war fighters fighting with each other. It's people in their villages, in their normal everyday lives, being bombed by very sophisticated jet bombers, right?
That's right. These are atrocities taking place. This is cruel, horrible, unconscionable acts against innocent people, flat out. That's what it is. I experienced it. I was there. I saw bombers fly over. I saw them dropping bombs. I saw people getting mutilated. I saw these people being transported, these casualties transported to the hospital. I saw them die in front of me. I saw the amputations. I saw lacerations. Mm. I saw some of the most heinous atrocities that you could ever imagine. So this is flat out a genocidal maniac focusing on innocent people and doing exactly what he did in Darfur.
I mean, that's it. I've heard quite a lot about Darfur,
sure.
And you know, obviously a lot of the interventions happening there. In fact, I've had friends who went out there and worked there. Why is it we haven't really heard anything about Nuba?
For that exact reason, because you heard so much about Darfur. I believe that this continues on in Africa in many parts of the continent. And now, because it took place in Darfur, and we rallied around, there's just a general amount of lackadaisical, yeah. Attitude towards it now. And unfortunately, we rallied, we put our bumper stickers on our cars, and that's still taking place in Darfur. So there's still an emphasis on that. But he is very clever. He decided, I'm going to continue this, and I'm going to go after a new, a region. And people just kind of gloss over, oh my God, it's Africa again. It's another Darfur. Do we really have the capacity to care about that? When we have the Syrias of the world, when we have the atrocities that are taking place, I believe, and trust me, I've been trying to market this film, I believe people are just burnt out. They're tired of this conflict. And it's a shame to say. I hate to say it because I am clearly all in. I made a film about it. I risked my life. I love Dr. Tom Katina and I love the Nuba people. But unfortunately, that doesn't translate around the world. There are other more important, there are more causes du jour right now that we care about. And that's okay because we should be focusing on some of them like Syria. And I'm all in with that too. But it unfortunately has bumped out, the Nuba Mountains and the Blue Nile District and the atrocities that are taking place there. The genocide that's taking place there, it's simply not as important.
I'm just wondering, what does he want from them? Is he just trying to wipe out a people? Does he want their loyalty? Does he want their resources? What is it that are they fighting? Like, they're not
all
rebels trying to...
All of the above. Mm. It's so hard for me to figure out. In Dr. Tom Katina, one of the brightest guys I know, graduated with me from Brown University back in the 80s, he is a brilliant mind. He can't figure it out. He's watching bombs come down. He's watching, he's being strafed, and he's bringing in all these casualties. He can't quite figure it out. We know that there are important resources there. We know that there's a difference between the Arab way of life and the African way of life, which the Nuba Mountains is more about the African way of life. Mm-hmm. We know that there's an interest in, and there's a tribal issue there. But you've never seen a more harmonious people.
Well, can you tell us about
ever?
Them? We'd like to learn about the Nuba people.
Yeah, I would love to tell you. Dr. Tom Katina told me when I embarked on this project, he said, "You will never find a more harmonious people in the world." Now, keep in mind, I've traveled the world. I've been in close to 100 countries in the world, and I have seen all different kind of cultures. I've experienced, so many different cultures. And I said, "Okay, Tom, I believe it. That'd be great." I cannot tell you what a compassionate group of people these are. And we're talking about Catholics, Protestants, Muslims, some Jewish people there, and animists. I mean, these people get along. They have for centuries. They've gotten along.
They live together in the same communities.
They live together. They're intermarried. Their families are, so welcoming. Mm-hmm. And I, not once in this entire region, I was there for 6 weeks, not once did I get asked for a handout. Not once did somebody say, "Hey, can you help me out?" And, usually in the marketplaces, in the airports, they're like, "Can you help me out? A little something here." Nothing. These people are so proud, and they're such a wonderful human. Tom Katina was actually, he was 100% right. They are the most harmonious people I have been around, and that was before the bombing started. That was before the conflict, took place. So it's not like they have this, this evil empire to rally against. Yeah, you can maybe say that. That could be part of the motivation for them getting along because they have a common cause. But before this even happened, before Bashir started picking on them, if you will, this was a very harmonious very connected, very strong community that cared for each other. So it just rocks my world to see people that have it so difficult in many ways. I mean, this is a region that experiences famine all the time. In fact, they're experiencing one right now. This is a region where it's if they don't get rainfall, you know, they've got a poor harvest and they've got, you know, serious issues there. It's hard to get a meal. All I ate there was basically beans, rice, and sorghum, you know, and that's about as good as it gets, which, you know, it's all relative. For these people, it's not so bad. But they have it pretty hard. I mean, it's an arid country, you know, and they don't exactly have luxuries. They have one hospital where Dr. Tom works.
Tell us about that. How did that happen?
That happened actually through the Catholic Church. They found this region and decided Max Gossis decided this part of the world needed the Catholic Church's attention, which he was, you know, 100% right. So he went in and he gave them the gift of life, which is water, and he put wells in throughout this whole area. Did not build churches. Did not build cathedrals. He went in and built wells and actually got these people hydrated. And then he built a hospital. And that was all done with Catholic, through the Catholic Church and through donations that came through the Catholic Church. Once that was up and running, they needed someone, a director of the hospital and a surgeon. And Tom Katina fit both of filled both those roles.
Well, tell us a little bit about that, because let's first find out about Tom. You said that you went to Brown with him. Tell us what he did there, what his life was like, and how he got from there to the Nuba Mountains.
Tom Katina is the closest that I have ever been to a saint on this earth. And I could tell you, back in college at Brown University in the 80s, he was just like that. We played on the same defensive line together. He was a nose guard, an All-American.
He was a football player.
He was a football player. He was a nose guard. He was All-American. I was a defensive end. I was not. He was a monster on the field. And we have footage of him tearing up the offensive lineman and ripping through to the quarterback. And he was an All-American. Now, if you know anything about football...
Which I don't.
Okay, well, then those two things don't go together, Ivy League and All-American, because...
Very few Ivy League students actually make it to the All-American list.
Yeah,
right?
There's like no scholarships. You know, we only allowed to offer academic scholarships, no athletic scholarships. So for someone that good to go to Brown and to perfect his craft and become, you know, the All-American was, it's really quite exceptional. So he was 240 pounds on the gridiron. He is 135 pounds now. Which is remarkable that he is just focused, you know. Well, Jim, how much do you weigh? 150?
A little bit more than that, okay. Probably just about 160.
Okay, so, you know, think of Jim minus 25 pounds.
Yeah.
I mean, it's that's slight from a guy that,
and
you
he's
know,
tall.
Yeah, he's 6'2".
I'm 6'2". I'm not. I'm 5'10", and I wear 160. He's got to be skinny as a rail.
Yeah, he is skinny as... So we knew something special was in store with for Tom Katina, but we just didn't know what. Well, we know now. He has he graduated from Brown with an engineering degree, and then he decided he had an epiphany. He wanted to become a doctor, and you know his father didn't have any more funds for him, so he went into the Navy, gave him 5 years, got out, and went into Duke. They paid for him to get his medical degree at Duke University, did his residency in Indianapolis, and then wanted to combine his missionary heart with his new medical degree, and he found himself in Kenya working in Nairobi to perfect his surgical craft, and then he ended up going into the rural parts of Kenya. Then this job, this opportunity showed up, and he applied for it, and they immediately jumped on, and he loves to tell the story that he showed up Nuba, which is it's in the small town, small village called Gedel. And keep in mind, there was no war when he showed up, you know, almost 10 years ago. So he shows up and they said, oh, I cannot believe, you know, you're here for, you know, and willing to take on this job for 3 years. And he's in the back of my head thinking, they only said one. But then he figured, you know, this is God's hand in it. And he just said, okay, I'm here for the next 3 years. Well, of course, now it's been over three times that amount. So that's how he got to... the Nuba Mountains. And he is the kind of person that just leaves it up to God. He says, God, use me as your instrument. And he has done just that. He has allowed God to direct him, and now he is providing hope for at least a million, if not more, people in this region. So it's remarkable to see what one human being can do.
Yeah, it is amazing. And when I saw the film, when I saw the trailer, I was moved. But when I saw the film, at the same time as it's beautifully shot.
Thank you.
It is such a compelling story about not only about the people of Nuba and their sort of camaraderie, but also about the terror that they're suffering. And when you talk about hospitals, I mean, most people here have a particular image in mind of what that means. But what is it actually like in on the ground there?
Yeah, this is just this is bricks and mortar. I mean, it's barely a hospital. I mean, it has the supplies there are ever so limited.
They don't have running water, do they? I mean,
they have running water, but it's just they've created a makeshift water tower, and so they have water pressure, but it's all, you know, it's all extremely archaic. You know,
when they're sterilizing their hands, when they're washing their things, they're pouring it out of a pot.
Well, yeah, and the only way that they got the pot, you know, the water in the pot warm is through a fire. So they literally take some of the, you know, regional wood and heat up a cauldron and scoop out the water. And literally, I tell this story all the time, but I was with Tom during a very difficult day in the OR, and he conducted, performed 17 cases. I mean, cases as in like three amputations, two or three lacerations, and two deliveries of babies. One was stillborn, and one of the most heinous things I've ever seen in my life, what he had to do, a DNC. And after these 17 cases, he takes a deep breath and then marches back to the compound where he lives, which is, you know, about a football field away. And he gets a ladder out and climbs up and starts washing the solar panels because there was a dust storm that day while he was in the emergency, in the OR. And the only way that we would have electricity for the next day for him to perform surgeries and for the hospital to run was, of course, through solar. And so he was concerned about, you know, when the sun came up the next day, that they would actually have clean solar panels and be able to produce a store of the electricity. So that's the kind of guy he is. He says, and I couldn't tell you any more than this, he is all in. It's remarkable when somebody does that, devotes themselves and takes one's humanitarian heart and just says, this is where I'm supposed to be. So, Jim, the hospital itself is as makeshift as you get. I mean, there's 350 beds, usually two to three people in each bed.
It's all on one floor, right?
It's all on one floor.
It's basically a warehouse.
It's a shell, yeah, and two to three people per bed. So you're talking about, head to feet, you know, and a lot of times, you like in the children's ward, pediatrics, there'll be three in a bed. Unfortunately, there's very, it's so rudimentary that, you know, when you have to urinate, a lot of times the kids just do it in the bed. And so there's constant cleanup, and people go right outside and defecate and urinate right outside the hospital. So that's a constant problem because this is the way they live in the bush.
So how big is the actual medical team, the staff there?
So the staff is about 120 people, and that fluctuates. Anybody that, on any given day, there's probably about 25 to 30 there.
He's the only one.
He's the only one.
There's no outside.
There's nothing. There's not. I mean, literally, he is the only surgeon there. He's the only doctor. He's the OBGYN. He is everything.
He's the pediatrician.
He's everything.
He's the guy who sets legs. He does surgery on a little girl, a baby's kidney. He removes one of them?
Yes, he removed an entire kidney and I think two-thirds of another. So she was left with a third of a quarter of a kidney.
Wow.
And she's, as of a year and a half ago when we updated the film, she was alive and well, but living in a cave because the family's home has been bombed relentlessly.
How many hours is he working a day?
It depends. I mean, he works, I would say, 17 hours a day. And the issue is, as I say, he's all in. During the night, I slept in a room adjacent to his. very primitive. And all night long, you hear this knock, 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 and you hear Dr. Tom, Dr. Tom. And he has an open door policy. He'll get 6 hours of sleep maximum. And during those 6 hours, he will be pulled out because of some emergency. You think about it, there's 400 or 500 people in this hospital, patients, and somebody's going to need your help, or somebody thinks they need his help, you know, during the night. So all night long, I would hear Dr. Tom, Dr. And he would get up and go out, and he would service. So I would imagine he gets anywhere from 2.5 to 5 hours of sleep a night. And
he works 365 days a year.
Yeah.
Every day.
Every day.
Full time. Monday through Sunday, through Monday through Sunday. And now what you're saying is he doesn't even get time off. I mean,
no.
It's
he never takes time. If he does take time, it's usually to go out of the country, to petition the UN to come back into the area, to try to help establish a humanitarian corridor. It's never about just taking some time in Mombasa and relaxing on the beach and just detoxing. It's always purposeful, all the time. It is, and when he's away from the hospital, which since I've known him, he's done it 4 times.
In how many years?
In 10, and those are all basically a week to maybe 10 days. He will be thinking nonstop the entire time about who is being affected in the hospital because he's no longer there. What patient is not being cared for in the proper way, and who's losing life because of his absence.
I'd like you to tell us a little bit about a couple of the victims that you touched on in the movie. One was a very sad tale of a little boy who kept calling for his mother, and the other was that girl who had cancer, if I'm not mistaken, and he removed 1 2/3 of her kidneys. So can you tell us about what their names are, who they are, what happened? Start with the boy.
Yeah, the unfortunate thing about visiting a place like this is that you come across the fortunate and unfortunate, issue is that you come across these stories that affect your life in a huge way, and they just rip your guts out. So in the long run, it's a positive thing because it has motivated me. But one of the stories that affected me the most and hit me so deeply was this a family, 9 kids, the Shanta family. So 9 kids were in a foxhole in a nearby village to the hospital, and they bombed Bashir bombed this village, and their tukul, their hut, was hit and ignited and collapsed onto this family, and 9 kids were burned, severely burned. 3 of them were killed there. 3 of them were killed in transit to the hospital, and there are 2 that survived, and one of the victims, Shanta, a 7-year-old boy, had 3rd-degree burns, and I was there when he came in, and it was just devastating to see the heinous nature of the skin when it's. I mean, these are 3rd-degree burns. I mean, it's just you could peel off.
It's like 70% of his body, right?
70%, and we actually were in the dirty OR, pulling off layers of skin of this little boy, and unfortunately, maggots, thousands of maggots were just scurrying out. It's because there's no care for these. I mean, Tom would come around once a day and he would clean him up. And, Tom would spend 20 minutes on this young man. So I found it upon, it moved me so much that I put my hands on this child every day and I prayed for him. And he would just look up, and be able to, say one thing. And we realized that he was screaming out for his mother, or he was whispering for his mother. It moved me to my core because here was a child away from his parents.
Did they survive?
I don't know what happened to the parents. I really don't. And I've been asked that. I don't know what happened. I should ask Tom Katina. He probably knows the Rolodex of victims that's in his head. But every day I went in and I prayed for him while I was there shooting this this film. And the next day, the day after I left, Shanta passed, and. And it just, it's to see that, no one should ever have to witness that. No family should ever have to go through that. But you know,
no child should ever have to experience that.
No child should ever have to suffer through anything. But that is just a typical case of what's happening. This relentless bombing, this reign of terror that this government has waged upon these people. It's just, it's unconscionable. There's no reason for it. I mean,
well,
these are innocent people. And it's not like they have, and the rebels, I've been to the rebel headquarters in Kauta, which is about 35, 40 minutes away from Gidel, Mother Mercy Hospital. There's no hardware there. There's guys with sticks and, you know, rocks. I mean, you know, they're mounting a campaign against the rebels. They like to, you know, they like to label them as the rebels and with this incredible cause, but they're basically just fighting for their lives.
But there are several times during your film where the hospital itself is getting bombed and bombs are dropping right around them. And these are not little bombs. These are Russian fighter jets who are dropping bombs on them, right?
These are Sukhois.
And bombers.
Yeah, these are supersonic jets that come in and strafe them and just, I mean, could blow the place to smithereens. They've tried, and for some reason, some people say it's the hand of God. Some say the blood of Jesus. Some say that it's just, you know, karma. They haven't actually hit the hospital all around it, and there's been damage, but they haven't had a direct hit yet. So, I mean, they are in the crosshairs. One of the first things I asked Tom Katina is like, listen, if we make a film about you in this conflict, is this going to, you know, further put your life in jeopardy? Is this a good idea? And you know what he said? He said, bring it on. He said, it can't get any worse than this. Mm. You know, because it's so bad there that, you know, he would welcome any effort to create awareness and to get this to stop.
So does the government know that he's there and, you know, he must... he must stand out to them. You know?
Not only do they know he's not only are they aware that he's there, but we actually got the film into the hands of the majority leader Mahdi Ibrahim through a connection of mine. I happened to have lunch with a woman that had strong connections in the Khartoum government, and she said, "Hey, I can get this to, you know, the appropriate parties. We can get it all the way up to Omar Hassan al-Bashir. We can get him to see your film." Well, you know, you can imagine that, you know, and there's a leading role for me, you know, in the next tent pole, you know, here in Hollywood. Right. You know, I mean, I just, you know, rolled my eyes at, okay.
You didn't believe it.
I didn't believe it for a second. I wanted to. That's my heart, you know, but I didn't think it was realistic. But sure enough, I got a call from this majority leader, Mahdi Ibrahim from Washington, D.C. He said, "I've heard about your film and I'd really like to see it." And I said, "All right, well, you know, if you want to see it, then come on out." He said, "Is there any chance you can come to Washington, D.C.?" I said, "No, if you'd like to see it, you can come out to Los Angeles." So he did. He showed up within a week. I had lunch with him to vet him in a way to see if he's actually someone I could trust. And he's an incredible human being. I like to say that he's a cross between MLK and James Earl Jones. I mean, just this incredible human being. And I trusted him. And so I showed him the film. And he was so deeply moved. First thing out of his mouth was like, I need to commend Dr. Tom for what he's doing. This is the right person at the right, you know, place. I commend you for going in and risking your life." He said, but I am shocked and I'm ashamed for my government. I had no idea this was happening. Sure, we knew there were bombs that were, you know, dropped, but we had no idea the collateral damage. I will make this my number one priority to stop the bombing in the Nuba Mountains. Once again, I went, okay, great, thank you. That would be really wonderful. Thanks. Get back to me on that. In 2 weeks, he actually called and said, "I want to let you know that we are suspending the bombing in the Blue Nile District and in the Nuba Mountains."
Wow.
That's amazing.
"And that your film is the primary reason for doing so." And so it really just hit me. It rocked my world that you can actually make a difference.
"My number one concern is that the hospital will be bombed someday. That at some point Bashir will just send some jets in and destroy it. He could kill everybody easily with those supersonic jets."
Now, let me just throw this out. There are a lot of variables, a lot of reasons for this. I was told it's the primary reason. We can all say it's perhaps the tipping point. But we know that there are sanctions against Sudan that have been eased recently. By Obama, you know, that was just one of his parting gifts. "We're going to ease the sanctions. We're going to give you a 6-month trial period And if you behave during that, then we are, you know, we'll play ball with you. We'll trade with you, if you will. So that's kind of hovering over them, this thought that they don't want another Darfur. I get it. There's also a thing called famine now taking place in Sudan, and it's bad. And so the idea before was all of the Sudanese would migrate into South Sudan to get away from this this war. Now these people are actually going back. Famine is so bad, they're choosing war over the famine. And so they're moving back. So the government has declared that they do not want to bomb while these innocent people, I use that term loosely, are now migrating into Sudan. So there are a lot of forces at work. And this, I think, has just basically created, you know, such awareness. They do not want another Darfur. They do not want to have these sanctions taken away or reinstated, if you will. So, but I know putting this in front of Bashir held a mirror up to him and basically said, look what you're doing. Look what the international community thinks of you. And just so you know, this is there's a moratorium on all journalists traveling in the Nuba Mountains into Sudan. They don't get a lot of information. When I contacted the embassy in Khartoum, they were so excited to hear from somebody that had been in the Nuba Mountains in this restricted area. So they picked my brain. They want to know everything they could because it's so hard to reach.
All right, but when you talked before about there's a sort of moratorium on this bombing, there's nothing that to prevent it from starting again, right, at this point.
This is a genocidal maniac. He can do whatever he wants.
So the danger is still there. The risk is still there. Especially
the risk
after
every day is
60
there.
60 days or 6 months.
There's still kids living in foxholes. Now, they get out more often and they feel at liberty to run around a lot more than they did before. But there's a constant threat. You never know when this is going to change. And Tom Katina does not believe in this at all. He goes, it's been a short break. It's been a respite from the bombing. But he doesn't believe because he's been, you know, he's been a witness to some of the, the atrocities, all of these atrocities. He just, you know, he doesn't believe it. But right now, you know, I think we've saved some lives. And that's, to me,
congratulations.
You know,
thank you. And that's a big deal. I was just reading about President Omar Hassan al-Bashir, who's wanted by the International Criminal Court on multiple counts of genocide and massive crimes against humanity in Darfur, and that he issued a very clear warning, which was about if anyone was going to try and overthrow the regime. He basically said, I'll tell you, why don't you criticize us in the streets? I will tell you why. We know that you will not come, as you know very well what happened in the past. And apparently the past is referring to a shoot-to-kill order that he had, and anyone who would say anything outright.
Any protest, any word against him or his regime, they will execute, they'll take care of. Ugh. It's that, you know, it's that way, you know, and there's a couple other, you got North Korea, you got some other places, Syria, you know, that experience this kind of, but this has been going on for a long time, and he's serious. He won't take any lip from anybody. I mean, that's just the way he is. So it's a serious dude. I mean,
well, that's true power and control, isn't it?
Yeah. And welcome to Africa. You know, we've seen this with Gaddafi. We've seen this with Idi Amin. We see with Mugabe. You know, we see this. It's not like
all
the first
psychopaths,
time.
All people who That's didn't right. give a damn about any other human being. All they cared right. about was themselves, and they've destroyed nations, and thousands of people, and even more have died as a result of that.
That's
it's
right.
It's terrible. But speaking of that, you mentioned before that you risk your life being there, and the listeners might think that means just that you could have been a victim of the bombing, but there was something else. I mean, when you landed in that airplane, right, the very first day. Yeah. Tell people about what happened.
My introduction is actually into South Sudan, and that country is experiencing, you know, equal upheaval. I mean, they're unhinged. I mean, this is the wild, wild west. I flew through Juba, and like 3 weeks prior, 15,000 people, according to their estimates, were murdered. So I flew through Juba, and I was very mindful of what had happened. In fact, my fixer that was supposed to go with me went MIA in Juba. So when I flew through Juba and then into Turele in South Sudan, I helped the pilot on this cargo plane that we flew for 2.5 hours with 17 teachers for the Catholic Church. I helped offload rice, beans, and sorghum, bags of 50 pound bags And once I finished that, I looked and I thought, I'm a journalist. I'm a photographer. What am I doing? I have this surge of children trying to get at this food, and I've got this scene that, you know, you don't get to, you know, see every day, and I haven't preserved it at all. So I stepped back, I put in my 16 millimeter lens, a fisheye lens, and shot it, through the hatch of this scene. And all of a sudden, this one character pointed at me and said, "Get the fuck off the plane." I'm like, "What?" He goes, "Now bring your camera." So I'm like, "Okay." So I got off the plane, and he started belly bucking and spitting on me, and said, "Who the fuck do you think we are? A bunch of monkeys here? Is that what you think?" And he was going after me, and so they confiscated my equipment, and boy soldiers came over, 12, 13, 14 year old kids, pointing AK-47s at me, and the wind was whipping through. It was a dirt tarmac, and 115 degrees out, and I thought, this is perhaps where I'm going to lose my life. Here on an airstrip in South Sudan. And after about 35 minutes of pleading with these guys, I finally mentioned that I knew Dr. Tom Katina, and the real reason I was there, not as just a volunteer for the Catholic Church, but to shoot a film about Dr. Tom Katina. And they stepped back and said, "Wait, you know Dr. Tom?" And I said, "Yeah, he's a friend of mine," explained. And I said, "I was just with your bishop, Maxis Gossis. I had coffee with him the day before." And then they said, "So wait a minute, do you know the bishop?" "Yes." "You know Dr. Tom?" "Yes." They let me go. And they gave me my cameras back. But
just a few days before that, didn't they take people off that same plane?
Exactly. So I got on the plane, and the pilot said to me, he said, "Do you know how lucky you are?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "Let's go." He said, "No, do you know how lucky you are?" I said, "Well, how so?" He said, "2 weeks ago, they pulled off 26 people off this very cargo plane. Took them to the corner of the airstrip, slit their throats, and let them bleed out." I said, "Get into the cockpit.
Let's go.
Turn on the engines. Yeah. Let's get the hell out of here." Yeah. I mean, it's that serious. And all of a sudden, I realized I needed my game. I needed to be on top of my game, because this was, you know, very serious people, and this are desperate people. You know, this desperate. So I went from there into the northern part of South Sudan. Stayed at a refugee camp called Yida, which is as desperate and perilous as you get. And I drove up the next morning. We started at 2:30 in the morning. I drove up, and as we were driving up into the Mother Mercy Hospital, which took us about 11 hours, Antonovs came over and bombed around us. And, you know, one time I had to jump out of the car. My driver jumped out and yelled something in Arabic and leapt into a ditch. And I went next, jumped in next to him, and bombs landed about two miles away, if I got the translation right. You know, and then we got up, dusted our stuff off, got him back in the vehicle, and moved on. It's just the way of life there. You know, and so, you know, while I was at the hospital, bombs were dropped around us. But I left. I got my story and I left.
Right.
These people are there. This is their home. This is their residence. And this is where Tom Katina chooses to live his life.
I knew that if I left, some people would die. Not that I'm a magician, but there are certain things I can do that someone will survive. That's just a fact. So by leaving, that to me says that my life is more important than other people's lives, which I don't agree with. You know, I think it's wrong. I think it's wrong thinking. So let me stick it out with these guys. Even if we got shelled and whatever, let's see what we can do. I'm in it. I'm all in.
That's my question to you. Like, what? I ask this to lots of documentarians. Like, how do you know when the story's over? I mean, you could go on and on and on. You know, there is so much. You could stay there for so long. You know, how do you know when it is time to leave?
Well, you know, you have pressures to get home. You have, you know, reasons you need to get home. So there's always a time clock when it comes to that. I've got a wife and three kids, and I needed to get back. And and Tom only had so much time and, you know, energy for me. To get an interview with him, it took me, you know, 7 days, even though I'm his buddy and we hung out all the time. To actually get a formal interview, it took forever. But documentarian work is never over.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm always thinking about the films that I've done in the past and the updates, and should I actually somehow sneak an update into the film, or do I make, you know, an addendum to? Do I do a postscript to? And, you know, so it's your work is never over. But I'll say in this case that, I really feel as if we've made a difference. It's certainly not over, but we've achieved great success with it already, and that's exciting. But you know, we can't let up. We cannot let up because this guy's not going to let up. He's not going to ease back. He's going to continue this reign of terror. So it's never over.
So what's next, Ken? What are the next steps?
Well, the next step is I've actually been offered, I've been asked to come back. I have an invitation to go back to Khartoum, not back to Khartoum, back to Sudan, to interview Bashir. Nicholas Kristof is going to attend as well.
And who's that?
He's the Pulitzer Prize winning New York Times author or the a reporter. And so I figured when I was asked that he would be a great guy to assist me, to go back with me, because he really truly does. I don't know if anybody reads this guy. I know a lot of people do. I don't know if you have. But he gives the voiceless a voice. He's one of my literary heroes, Nicholas Kristof. He's actually been to Mother Mercy Hospital, and he wrote 3 articles about Dr. Tom, and he's raised over $400,000 for this cause, for the Mother Mercy Hospital. He is in deep. So I figured if we both go back, we interview him, and we're supposed to have this Al-Shura, which is a meeting of the minds. It is a negotiation. They want to bring in principals from authorities from the Nuba Mountains, and Bashir is going to participate, and people in the Senate, in their parliament there, and they want to have this meeting of the minds and really try to figure out how to best go, you know, to go about, you know, ending this. And I know they're serious because of what's happened already, because of this Mahdi Ibrahim. But who knows? You know, there's so many forces at work here. But I'm thrilled to say that, you know, that we have an opportunity to maybe make even a bigger difference. But that has yet to play out. That's supposed to be in May.
So, Ken, we know that you're trying to market this film because you're trying to get the story out to the world, because it's so important and it's so powerful and disturbing at the same time. But what has been your experience with that?
Yeah, I mean, the Heart of Nuba has screened on every continent. It's been seen by the House of Lords, the U.S. Congress, the Italian Senate, The Hague. So
why can't
any of our listeners go? Yeah.
Why isn't it at theaters?
There's the million-dollar question.
Why isn't it on Netflix? Why isn't it on?
Very difficult, very difficult film to market. And I didn't think so, because we have a true hero. I'm not talking about an American hero or a white person. I'm just talking about a genuine hero. So I thought, you know, this would be a great story that people could relate to.
But he is an American hero.
He's just
medical practice here to go and basically volunteer there. And he's been there for how many years now?
He's been in Africa for almost 20, but been in the Nuba Mountains for almost 10. Yeah. Yeah. Why is this not a film that's resonated or been picked up by film festivals and distributors? You know, that's the million-dollar question, you know, and I can tell you this much right now. I've been to Sundance with several films. My films have been picked up and distributed, and we've had great, you know, great runs with them. This one didn't get into Sundance and didn't get into Toronto, didn't get into the film festivals that I've been in before. And I've heard every excuse, you know.
Like what?
Well, every excuse is brilliant film, it's fantastic, just doesn't fit our programming. Which is code word for it's really hard to program. It's really hard to market this film. The bottom line is it's about Africa, okay? That's not sexy. It's about black kids in foxholes. That's not so sexy, okay? It's coming off the heels of Darfur. People are burnt out. You know, people, you know, are complacent about what's happening there. It doesn't grab, you know, headlines. It's about a true hero. It actually makes the Catholic Church look good. You know, and when I say that it's about a hero, I said this at the CAA screening we had the other night. You know, if we expose that Dr. Tom Katina was a pedophile at the end of the film, it would have been snapped up in a heartbeat. And that just says something about, you know, about our society. We love to see into the, you know, the underbelly of you know, someone. You know, we love to see the ugly and that sells. And this is actually a human being that hits the ball down the fairway every single day, even keeled. He's not broken. I mean, there's in ways he's broken, but you know, we all are. But he has no exposure. This is a guy that has everything going for him. His family, they all love him. He's got mother and father still alive. All his brothers and sisters, all six of them with their children, all love him and support him. He's not running from anything. Mm-hmm. That happens all the time in these fields. You know, people are running from something, so they want to, you know, volunteer here and there and just get away from it. He has, you know, the most incredible network of support from his family. So everything is just beautiful about this. Well, so it's hard to get a distributor to say, I like that. It works on many levels. For the reasons I just said. So it's been an uphill battle.
Okay, but our listeners at Real Crime Profile care about the victims. That's what they do. So how can they help you get this into some form of distribution so that the world can see it?
Well, thank you for asking that, because that's a very important question. What you can do is you go on our website, theheartofnuba.com, and you can actually reach out to senators and congressmen and tell them about the problem. This is for awareness. You can go to Netflix, and actually there's a way on their website that you can log a suggestion and to air this. If you know anybody in distribution, let them know that this film exists. Go on to theheartofnuba.com, take a look at the trailer, look at and see where the film is playing around you. The way I went about this is to create a coalition, a human rights coalition, because I wasn't connecting with Hollywood. So I decided to put together Amnesty International and Act for Sudan and Human Rights Watch and Operation Broken Silence. I put together an NGO, a coalition of NGOs, about 65 of them, one of the largest coalitions ever to be created. And we decided to go out into the world and to prove to them this is a film worth seeing and this is a cause worth rallying around. So we went to the House of Lords, to Westminster Palace, and we screened the film there. We went to Congress and we screened on Capitol Hill. We went to Rome and showed the film to the Italian Senate. We went to the International Criminal Court and we showed the film in The Hague. That's how we've gone about it. We've had great success because people are actually doing something now and they're reaching out, and we have created this huge, huge coalition, and this awareness is huge. That's why I think a distributor would come along and just go, oh, this is low hanging fruit. Oh my gosh, you know, we've got Amnesty International with 7 million members, and they have already shown the film 4 times for their regional meetings. Oh my God, this is a built in audience. And it's, as Jim said, thank you. It's beautifully shot. I mean, it's a compelling story, and it's a real hero. It's just that Hollywood doesn't embrace this kind of material that often. I've found out, which is okay, because I'm going to continue to fight, and I'm going to get it into the right hands, and eventually we're going to get it out there, just so we can create the awareness, so we can stop this, not just suspend it, but stop it for good.
But it's interesting, because in an atmosphere in which Moonlight wins the Academy Award for Best Picture, a picture that was an independent film that was about a topic that doesn't resonate with everybody. There's certainly a lot of people that are not open to the issues that they discuss in that film. Yet it seems like Hollywood at least made efforts to embrace it.
Well, I mean, let me just say this. You know, it is a crowded marketplace, and you're absolutely right. And I think things do come and go. You know, the Syrian documentaries this year were very, you know, had a lot of attention. You know, I don't want to peg on the entirety of Hollywood just yet. You know, I have a lot of faith in my industry that it can get picked up and more eyeballs can come to it. So, and that's what we would like to help you do, certainly. And certainly already our listeners have expressed interest in it. One of our listeners, you know, definitely recommends, you know, us reaching out to the Traverse City Film Festival in Michigan. That's Michigan, right?
Yeah, it's Michael Moore's.
Yeah,
Michael Moore's film festival.
So, if you live in that area and you want to write to Mr. Moore and tell him about this documentary, that would be helpful.
Check out the trailer, and then if you're interested and you like what Ken has said today, and it's a really compelling story, and what Dr. Tom Katina has done, and the sacrifices he's made, and the people's lives that he's changed and saved. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And I'm just reading a quote from Dr. Tom, which is on your website and on your Twitter feed as well, where you can watch the trailer, but the petition's there as well, where you can add your name. And it says, as Dr. Tom has said, his log is incomplete. That's of the victims. It doesn't include the thousands who've been displaced, whose homes and fields have been obliterated, or the children who've grown up in foxholes. It is our hope that this movie will give a voice to the voiceless, Tom said. Let the dead and maimed have their day in court and add your name to the witness list.
Yeah.
I mean, that sounds a lot like what our theme is here at Real Crime Profile. Yeah. We've tried to give voices to the people who were murdered, people who were taken advantage of, victims of crimes, when what the media typically does is give a voice to the bad guys, to the horrific people who caused the damage, and not the people who were actually victimized and their families and the ripple effect of that. And I think that was one of the things that struck me the most. And I'll be honest, I mean, it surprised me when I heard you speak and I saw your presentation, how affected I was by the humanity of it and the lack of humanity that Bashir is exhibiting, and just the incredible grace with which Dr. Tom Katina lives his life. I mean, he is actually living it. He's not just talking the talk or even walking the walk. He's living it full time every day. And it's just amazing that there are people that good out there.
It is, and it's a blessing, and it provides hope for not only a million plus people in the Nuba Mountain region, but it provides hope for me and for a lot of other people here that have seen the film. And that's why we want to get the message out, because you can do so much more than you're doing, and it doesn't take much. You don't have to get your medical degree and go to the Nuba Mountains and save lives and perform amputations. You can do it right here in your own community. You can focus on so many of the problems that we have here, or so many of the benevolent causes. So you can find a little bit of Tom Katina in each and every one of us. And
absolutely.
That's, you know, he professes and he believes this to the fullest of his being, that every life holds the promise of hope. And that's why he's there doing what he's doing, because he believes that that, you know, newborn baby that we show in the film is as important as his, that person's life, that child's life is as important as his or Bashir's or anybody else's. And he lives that life. And very few people that I know actually live out the words that they speak.
Okay, well, we're going to post the link to the trailer, and we'll post a link to your site. And hopefully our listeners will watch the trailer and contact any people they know in any media outlets to try to get this this amazing film out there.
And sign the petition as well.
Absolutely.
And spread the word on social media and support.
Thank you.
And use Dr. Tom as an example. I mean, and I know Dr. Tom says you don't have to come to Africa. There's plenty of work that needs to be done where everybody lives.
That's right. So, find your own Calcutta, as Mother Teresa would say. Find your own Calcutta. It's everywhere around you. You don't need to go to Calcutta. You don't need to go to Nuba. You can find it in your own neighborhood, in your own homes, your own schools. So,
but please help Dr. Katina do what he's doing.
Yes.
Because he's the only doctor for a million people who are suffering very badly. Well, thank you so much.
Thank
Ken,
you.
For
thank
coming.
You very much.
I mean, we really appreciate it. And I really believe our listeners are the kind of people who care enough to do something. And now we've given them a mission.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's up to you guys. Come on.
Yeah, please.
Step up.
Rally behind Ken and get this movie out there so that everybody will know what's going on rather than, you know, just a select few. I will say, though, isn't there a screening coming up in L.A. soon?
Yeah, we're having a screening at USC on April 25th, so it's around the corner on Wednesday night. And it's posted on our website, so take a look at, once again, heartofnuba.com, and you can find the details there. I believe it's 7 o'clock. And
I will be there. I'll be there with bells on.
Great. And do they have to get tickets for it? How does that work?
No, you can show up. You'll have to pay for parking, but it's at Annenberg School of Communication. So great. You can show up, pay $7 to park, but free film.
Thank
Sounds
you.
Great.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
So if you enjoy our podcast and would like to support us, there are a couple of important things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and give us a positive 5-star review. You can check out our sponsors and take advantage of the special promotions for Real Crime Profile listeners. You can go over and like our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter. But most importantly, you can share our podcast with friends, family, and anyone you know would be interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. So thank you for listening.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline, free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website www.genesisshelter.org or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.
If you're a regular listener to the show, you know we have great brands like Blue Apron, Audible, and Casper advertising with us, and they keep coming back because our listeners really respond to them, which we're really thankful for. Well, if you happen to own a business or manage the advertising buy for one, then you should consider advertising on Real Crime Profile. Podcast advertising is on the rise, and it's one of the most effective ways of reaching consumers on the go today. So please go to wondery.com/advertisers. Again, it's wondery.com/advertisers. And get in touch with us. Thanks.